Chapter 6. Beginnings and Becomings. Potentiality is the key. Our immediate task is to start from a lot of vacuum and a few rules and convince you that they have enormous potentiality. Given enough time, they can lead to people, turtles, weather, the internet. Hold it. Where did all that vacuum come from? Either the universe has been around forever, or once there wasn't a universe, and then there was. The second statement fits neatly with the human predilection for creation myths. It also appeals to today's scientists, possibly for the same reason. Lies to children run deep. Isn't vacuum just empty space? What was there before we had space? How do you make space? Out of vacuum? Isn't that a vicious circle? If in the past we didn't have space, how can there have been a there for whatever it was to exist in? And if there wasn't anywhere for it to exist, how did it manage to make space? Maybe space was there all along, but why? And what about time? Space is easy compared to time. Space is just somewhere to put matter. Matter is just stuff. But time flows, time passes. Time makes sense in the past and the future, but not in the instantaneous frozen present. What makes time flow? Could the flow of time be stopped? What would happen if it did? There are little questions, there are medium-sized questions, and there are big questions. After which there are even bigger questions, huge questions, and questions so vast that it is hard to imagine what kind of response would count as an answer. You can usually recognize the little questions. They look immensely complicated. Things like, what is the molecular structure of the left-handed isomer of glucose? As the questions get bigger, they become deceptively simpler. Why is the sky blue? The really big questions are so simple that it seems astonishing that science has absolutely no idea how to answer them. Why doesn't the universe run backwards instead? Or, why does red look like that? All this goes to show that it's a lot easier to ask a question than it is to answer it. And the more specialized your question is, the longer are the words that you must invent to state it. Moreover, the bigger a question is, the more people are interested in it. Hardly anybody cares about left-handed glucose, but nearly all of us wonder why red looks the way it does, and we vaguely wonder whether it looks the same to everybody else. Out on the fringes of scientific thought are questions that are big enough to interest almost everybody, but small enough for there to be a chance of answering them reasonably accurately. They are questions like, how did the universe begin? And how will it end? What happens in between is quite a different matter. Let us acknowledge right up front that the current answers to such questions depend upon various questionable assumptions. Previous generations have been absolutely convinced that their scientific theories were well nigh perfect, only for it to turn out that they had missed the point entirely. Why should it be any different for our generation? Beware of scientific fundamentalists who try to tell you everything is pretty much worked out, and only a few routine details are left to do. It is just when the majority of scientists believe such things that the next revolution in our world view creeps into being, its feeble birth squeaks all but drowned by the ear-splitting roar of orthodoxy. Let's take a look at the current view of how the universe began. One of the points we're going to make is that human beings have trouble with the concept of beginning, and even more trouble, let it be said, with becoming. Our minds evolve to carry out rather specific tasks, like choosing a mate, killing bears with a sharp stick, and getting dinner without becoming it. We've been surprisingly good at adapting those modules to tasks for which they were never intended. That is, tasks for which they were not used during their evolution. There being no conscious intention, such as planning a route up the Matterhorn, carving images of sea lions on polar bears' teeth, not while these are still in the polar bear, and calculating the combustion point of a complex hydrocarbon molecule. Because of the way our mental modules evolved, we think of beginnings as being analogous to how a day begins, or how a hike across the desert begins. We think of becomings in the same way that a polar bear's tooth becomes a carved amulet, or a live spider becomes dead when you squash it. That is, beginnings start from somewhere, which is where whatever it is begins, and becomings turn thing one into thing two, by pushing it across a clearly defined boundary. The tooth was not carved, but now it is. The spider was not dead, but now it is. Unfortunately, the universe doesn't work in such a simple-minded manner, so we have serious trouble thinking about how a universe can begin, or how an ovum and a sperm can become a living child. Let us leave becomings for a moment and think about beginnings. Thanks to our evolutionary prejudices, we tend to think of the beginning of the universe as being some special time, before which the universe did not exist, and after which it did. Moreover, when the universe changed from not being there to being there, something must have caused that change, something that was around before the universe began, otherwise it wouldn't have been able to cause the universe to come into being. When you bear in mind that the beginning of the universe is also the beginning of space and the beginning of time, however, this point of view is distinctly problematic. How can there be a before if time has not yet started? How can there be a cause for the universe starting up without space for that cause to happen in and time for it to happen? Maybe there was something else in existence already. But now we have to decide how that got started, and the same difficulties arise. All right, let's go the whole hog. Something, perhaps the universe itself, perhaps some precursor, was around forever. It didn't have a beginning. It just was. Always. Satisfied? Things that exist forever don't have to be explained, because they don't need a cause. Then what caused them to have been around forever? It now becomes impossible not to mention the turtle joke. Stephen Hawking tells it at the start of A Brief History of Time, but it goes back a lot further. According to Hindu legend, the earth rides on the back of four elephants which ride on a turtle. But what supports the turtle? In Discworld, great Atuin needs no support, swimming through the universe unperturbed by any thought about what holds it up. That's magic in action. World-carrying turtles are like that. But according to the old lady who espoused the Hindu cosmology and was asked the same question by a learned astronomer, there is a different answer. It's turtles all the way down. The image of an infinite pile of turtles is instantly ludicrous, and very few people find it a satisfying explanation. Indeed, very few people find it a satisfying kind of explanation, if only because it doesn't explain what supports the infinite pile of turtles. However, most of us are quite content to explain the origins of time as, it's always been there. Seldom do we examine this statement closely enough to realize that what it really says is, it's time all the way back. Now replace time by turtle and back by down. Each instant of time is supported, that is, a causal consequence of the previous instant of time. Fine, but that doesn't explain why time exists. What caused that infinite expanse of time? What holds up the whole pile? All of which puts us in a serious quandary. We have problems thinking of time as beginning without a precursor, because it's hard to see how the causality goes. But we have equally nasty problems thinking of time as beginning with a precursor, because then we hit the turtle pile problem. We have similar problems with space. Either it goes on forever, in which case it's space all the way out, and we need somewhere even bigger to put the whole thing, or it stops, in which case we wonder what's outside it. The real point is that neither of these options is satisfactory, and the origins of space and time fit neither model. The universe is not like a village which ends at a fence or an imaginary line on the ground. Neither is it like the distant desert, which seems to vanish into eternity but actually just gets too far away for us to see it clearly. Time is not like a human lifespan which starts at birth and ends at death, nor is it like the extended lifespan found in many religions, where the human soul continues to live indefinitely after death. and the much rarer belief, held for example by Mormons, that some aspect of each person was somehow already alive in the indefinite past. So how did the universe begin? Begin is the wrong word. Nonetheless, there is good evidence that the age of the universe is about 15 billion years, so nothing, not space, not time, existed before some instant of time, roughly 15 billion years ago. This figure replaces the previously favoured value of about 20 billion years. Recently, lots of scientists collectively decided it should be 15 billion instead. For a while, some stars seem to be older than the universe, but the age of those stars has also been downsized. In other circumstances, they might well have settled for 20 billion. If this worries you, substitute the term a very long time. See how our narrativium-powered semantics confuses us? This does not mean that if you went back 15 billion and 1 years, you would find nothing. It means that you cannot go back 15 billion and 1 years. That description makes no sense. It refers to a time before time began, which is logically incoherent, let alone physically so. This is not a new point. St. Augustine made it very clearly in his Confessions of about 400, when he said, "If there was no time before heaven and earth were created, how can anyone ask what you, God, were doing then? If there was no time, there was no then." Some have gone to greater extremes. In The End of Time, Julian Barber argues that time does not exist. In his view, the real laws of physics specify a static universe of timeless nows. He argues that time is not a physical dimension in the way that space is. The apparent flow of time is an illusion, created because the collection of nows that corresponds to a human being makes that human experience its world as if it were an ordered series of events, happening one after the other. Apparent gaps of duration between successive events are merely blanks, where no now exists. Thief of Time explores some remarkably similar issues from the Discworld viewpoint, but for this book we will take a conventional attitude towards time, and consider it to be a real part of physics. Cosmologists are pretty sure that it all began like this. The universe came into being as a tiny speck of space and time. The amount of space inside this tiny speck grew rapidly, and time began to elapse, so that rapidly actually had a meaning. Everything that there is today, right out into the furthest depths of space, stems from that astonishing beginning. Colloquially, the event is known as the Big Bang. The name reflects several features of the event. For example, that tiny speck of space-time was enormously hot and grew in size exceedingly rapidly. It was like a huge explosion, but there was no stick of cosmic dynamite sitting there in no space with its non-material fuse burning away as some kind of pre-time pseudo-clock counted down the seconds to detonation. What exploded was nothing. Space, time, and matter are the products of that explosion. They played no part in its cause. Indeed, in a very real sense, it had no cause. The evidence in favour of the Big Bang is twofold. The first item is the discovery that the universe is expanding. The second is that echoes from the Big Bang can still be detected today. The possibility that the universe might be getting bigger first appeared in mathematical solutions to equations formulated by Albert Einstein. Einstein viewed space-time as being curved. A body moving through curved space-time deviates from its normal straight-line path, much as a marble rolling on a curved surface does. This deviation can be interpreted as a force, something that pulls the body away from that ideal straight line. Actually, there is no pull, just a bend in space-time, causing a bend in the body's path. But it looks as if there's a pull. Indeed, this apparent pull is what Newton called gravity, back in the days when people thought it really did pull bodies together. Anyway, Einstein wrote down some equations for how such a bendy universe ought to behave. They were very difficult equations to solve, but after making some extremely strong assumptions, basically that at any instant of time, space is a sphere, Mathematical physicists worked out a few answers, and this tiny, very special list of solutions, the only ones their feeble methods could find, told them three things that the universe could do. It could stay the same size forever, it could collapse down to a single point, or it could start from a single point and grow in size without limit. We now know that there are many other solutions to Einstein's equations, leading to all sorts of bizarre behavior, but back in the days when today's paradigm was being set, these solutions were the only ones anybody knew, so they assumed that the universe must behave according to one or other of those three solutions. Science was subliminally prepared either for continuous creation, the universe is always the same, or for the Big Bang, the Big Crunch, in which the universe shrinks to an infinitely dense, infinitely hot point, lacked psychological appeal. Enter Edwin Hubble, an American astronomer. Hubble was observing distant stars, and he made a curious discovery. The further away the stars were, the faster they were moving. He knew this for distinctly indirect but scientifically impeccable reasons. Stars emit light, and light has many different colors, including colors that the human eye is unable to see, colors like infrared, ultraviolet, radio, X-ray. Light is an electromagnetic wave, and there is one color for each possible wavelength of light, the distance from one electromagnetic peak to the next. For red light, this distance is 2.8 hundred-thousandths of an inch, 0.7 millionths of a meter. Hubble noticed that something funny was happening to the light emitted by stars. The colors were shifting in the red direction. The further away a star was, the bigger the shift. He interpreted this red shift as a sign that the stars are moving away from us, because there is a similar shift for sound, known as the Doppler effect, and it's caused by the source of the sound moving. So the further away the stars are, the faster they're traveling. This means that the stars aren't just moving away from us, they're moving away from each other, like a flock of birds dispersing in all directions. The universe, said Hubble, is expanding. Not expanding into anything, of course. It's just that the space inside the universe is growing. Indeed, impeccable Discworld thinking is that no matter how big the universe grows, it's always the same size. That made the physicists' ears prick up, because it fitted exactly one of their three scenarios for changes in the size of the universe. Stay the same, grow, collapse. They knew it had to be one of the three, but which? Now they knew that too. If we accept that the universe is growing, we can work out where it came from by running time backwards, and this time-reversed universe collapses back to a single point. Putting time the right way round again, it must all have grown from a single point, the Big Bang. By estimating the rate of expansion of the universe, we can work out that the Big Bang happened about 15 billion years ago. There is further evidence in the Big Bang's favor. It left echoes. The Big Bang produces vast amounts of radiation, which spreads through the universe. Over billions of years, the remnants of the Big Bang's radiation smeared out into the cosmic background, a kind of low-level simmering of radiant energy across the sky, the light analog of a reverberating echo of sound. It is as if God shouted, "Hello!" at the instant of creation, and we can still hear a faint "hello, hello, hello, hello" from the distant mountains. On Discworld, this is exactly the case, and the listening monks in their remote temples spend their whole lives straining to pick out from the sounds of the universe the faint echoes of the words that set it in motion. According to the details of the Big Bang, the cosmic background radiation should have a temperature, the analogue of loudness, of about 3 degrees Kelvin. 0 degrees Kelvin is the coldest anything can get, equivalent to about -273 degrees Celsius. Astronomers can measure the temperature of the cosmic background radiation, and they do indeed get 3 degrees Kelvin. The Big Bang isn't just a wild speculation. Not so long ago, most scientists didn't want to believe it, and they only changed their minds because of Hubble's evidence for the expansion of the universe, and that impressively accurate figure of 3 degrees Kelvin, for the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. It was indeed a very loud and hot bang. We are ambivalent then about beginnings. Their creation myth aspect appeals to our sense of narrative imperative, but we sometimes find the first it wasn't then it was lie to children unpalatable. We've even more trouble with becomings. Our minds attach labels to things in the surrounding world, and we interpret those labels as discontinuities. If things have different labels, then we expect there to be a clear line of demarcation between them. The universe, however, runs on processes rather than things, and a process starts as one thing and becomes another, without ever crossing a clear boundary. Worse, if there is some apparent boundary, we are likely to point to it and shout, "That's it!" just because we can't see anything else worth getting agitated about. How many times have you been in a discussion in which somebody says, "We have to decide where to draw the line"? For instance, most people seem to accept that, in general terms, women should be permitted abortions during the earlier stages of pregnancy, but not during the very late stages. Where you draw the line, though, is hotly debated, and of course some people wish to draw it at one extreme or the other. There are similar debates about exactly when a developing embryo becomes a person with legal and moral rights. Is it at conception, where the brain first forms? At birth? Or was it always a potential person, even when it existed as one egg and one sperm? The draw-a-line philosophy offers a substantial political advantage to people with hidden agendas. The method for getting what you want is first to draw the line somewhere that nobody would object to, and then gradually move it to where you really want it, arguing continuity all the way. For example, having agreed that killing a child is murder, the line labelled murder is then slid back to the instant of conception. Having agreed that people should be allowed to read whichever newspaper they like, you end up supporting the right to put the recipe for nerve gas on the internet. If we were less obsessed with labels and discontinuity, it would be much easier to recognize that the problem here is not where to draw the line, it is that the image of drawing a line is inappropriate. There is no sharp line, only shades of grey that merge unnoticed into one another, despite which one end is manifestly white and the other is equally clearly black. An embryo is not a person, but as it develops, it gradually becomes one. There is no magic moment at which it switches from non-person to person. Instead, it merges continuously from one into the other. Unfortunately, our legal system operates in rigid black-and-white terms, legal or illegal, no shades of grey. And this causes a mismatch, reinforced by our use of words as labels. A kind of triage might be better. This end of the spectrum is legal, that end of the spectrum is illegal, and in between is a grey area, which we do our best to avoid if we possibly can. If we can't avoid it, we can at least adjust the degree of criminality and the appropriate penalty according to whereabouts in the spectrum the activity seems to lie. Even such obviously black and white distinctions as alive, dead, or male-female turn out on close examination to be more like a continuous merging than a sharp discontinuity. Pork sausages from the butchers contain many live pig cells. With today's techniques, you might even clone an adult pig from one. A person's brain can have ceased to function, but their body, with medical assistance, can keep going. There are at least a dozen different combinations of sex chromosomes in humans, of which only XX represents the traditional female and XY the traditional male. Although the Big Bang is a scientific story about a beginning, it also raises important questions about becomings. The Big Bang theory is a beautiful bit of science, very nearly consistent with the picture we now have of the atomic and the subatomic world, with its diverse kinds of atoms, their protons and neutrons, their clouds of electrons, and the more exotic particles that we see when cosmic rays hit our atmosphere, or when we insult the more familiar particles by slamming them together very hard. Physicists have now found, or perhaps invented, the allegedly ultimate constituents of these familiar particles. More exotic things known as quarks, gluons, at least the names are becoming familiar. The holy grail of particle physics has been to find the Higgs boson, which, if it exists, explains why the other particles have mass, In the 1960s, Peter Higgs suggested that space is filled with a kind of quantum treacle called the Higgs field. He suggested that this field would exert a force on particles through the medium of the Higgs boson, and that force would be observed as mass. For 30 years, physicists have constructed ever larger and more energetic particle accelerators in the search for this elusive particle, such as the new Large Hadron Collider, due to start up in 2007. Late in 2001, scientists analysing data from its predecessor, the Large Electron-Positron Collider, LEP, announced that the Higgs boson probably doesn't exist. If it does, then it has to be even more massive than everyone expected, and the LEP scientists are sceptical. No good substitute for Higgs's theory exists, not even the fashionable concept of supersymmetry, which pairs every known particle with a more massive partner. Supersymmetry predicts several Higgs particles, with masses well inside the range where the LEP data prove that no such thing exists. Some physicists still hope that the Higgs boson will show up when the new accelerator comes online. But if it doesn't, particle physics will have to rethink the entire basis of their subject. Whatever happens to the Higgs boson, they're already starting to wonder whether there are more layers of reality further down, particles more ultimate still. Turtles all the way down? Does physics go all the way down, or does it stop at some level? If it stops, is that the ultimate secret, or just the point beyond which the physicist's way of thinking fails? The conceptual problem here is difficult because the universe is a becoming, a process, and we want to think of it as a thing. We don't only find it puzzling that the universe was so different back then, that particles behave differently, that the universe then became the universe now, and will perhaps eventually cease expanding and collapse back to a point in a big crunch. We are familiar with babies becoming children, becoming adults, but these processes always surprise us. We like things to keep the same character, so becoming is difficult for our minds to handle. There is another element of the first moments of our universe that is even more difficult to think about. Where did the laws come from? Why are there such things as protons and electrons, quarks and gluons? We usually separate processes into two conceptually distinct causal chunks: the initial conditions and the rules by which they are transformed as time passes. For the solar system, for instance, the initial conditions are the positions and speeds of the planets at some chosen instant of time. The rules are the laws of gravitation and motion, which tell us how those positions and speeds will change thereafter. But for the beginning of the universe, the initial conditions seem not to be there at all. Even there isn't there. So it seems that it's all done by rules. Where did the rules come from? Did they have to be invented, or were they just sitting in some unimaginable timeless pseudo-existence, waiting to be called up? Or did they uncurl in the early moments of the universe as something appeared, so that the universe invented its own rules along with space and time? Two recent books by top-ranking scientists explore how rules could be invented. The most recent is Stuart Kaufman's 2000 Investigations. This is mainly aimed at biology and economics, but it begins with rules of physics. In a new answer to the old question, what is life, Kaufman defines a life form to be an autonomous agent, any entity or system that can redirect energy and reproduce. Autonomous here means that such a system makes up its own rules, determines its own behavior. Such life forms need not be at all conventional. For example, the quantum mechanical vacuum is a seething mass of particles and antiparticles, being created and annihilated in amazingly complicated ways. A vacuum has more than enough complexity to organize itself into an autonomous agent. If it did, then quantum mechanics would be able to make up its own rules. The other noteworthy book on this topic is Lee Smolin's 1997 The Life of the Cosmos, which asks, can universes evolve? A remarkable feature of our universe is the presence of black holes. These are regions of space-time that contain so much mass that light and matter cannot get out. They are formed by the collapse of massive stars. It used to be thought that black holes are rare, but now they seem to be showing up all over the place, in particular at the cores of most galaxies. Theoretical work shows that the constants of our universe are unusually good for making black holes. Why? Smolin argues that each black hole in our universe is in effect a doorway to an adjacent universe. But because nothing can come out of a black hole, we cannot know what's on the far side of that door. In particular, the adjacent universe might have different fundamental constants compared to ours. So universes could breed by budding off baby universes through black holes, and natural selection would favour those that had the most offspring, whose constants would automatically be unusually good for making black holes. So maybe we live in one of those babies. There are some difficulties with this theory. In particular, how would selection work? How can universes compete? But it's an interesting, if rather wild, idea. And it offers a concrete proposal about how a universe can make up its laws. Some, at least, could be imposed upon it at birth. The Big Bang, then, may have done more than just bringing space and time into being. It may also have brought the rules of physics, the ones that now apply to our world, into being. During the becoming of its first moments, our universe kept changing its state, changing the rules it accessed. In this respect, it was rather like a flame, which changes its composition according to its own dynamics and the things that it is burning. Flames are all more or less the same shape, but they don't inherit that shape from a parent. When you set light to a piece of paper, the flame builds itself from scratch, using the rules of the outside universe. In the opening instance of the universe, it wasn't just substances, temperatures, and sizes that changed. The rules by which they changed also changed. We don't like to think this way. We want immutable laws, the same, always. So we look for deeper laws to govern how the rules changed. Possibly the universe is really governed by these deeper laws. But perhaps it just makes up its own rules as it goes along.